From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we'll start this hour, as we have so many times in recent days, with a tragedy in London. Officials say a 47-year-old man drove a van into a crowd of worshippers near the Finsbury Park Mosque in London just after midnight. One man was killed, but he was already receiving first aid for a medical emergency. At least 10 people were injured. The man who drove the van is in custody. Prime Minister Theresa May visited the scene today and condemned the attack.
This was an attack on Muslims near their place of worship. And like all terrorism, in whatever form, it shares the same fundamental goal. It seeks to drive us apart and to break the precious bonds of solidarity and citizenship that we share in this country. We will not let this happen.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson is outside the mosque in London. And Rob, first of all, what more do we know about the attack?
Well, we don't know very much about the attacker, other than that he was white. Interestingly, he wasn't known to the authorities, so to the extent that they monitor right-wing extremists as well as Islamist extremists, he doesn't seem to have been on their radar. And eyewitnesses have told us exactly what happened, that it was late night, early morning. People were coming out of the mosque. The man drove his van very obviously, directly, intentionally to harm people, and specifically, clearly, to harm Muslims. He was then tackled, and eyewitnesses have told us, told the BBC, that they certainly set about him for a while. I think he was given quite a kicking before the police arrived.
And do people feel that this was a revenge attack? Has that been talked about at all?
I don't know whether they feel that or not, but I mean, I guess what really worries the authorities is this idea of, you know, if there's one thing that Islamist extremists and right-wing extremists have in common, is this idea that they don't believe that Muslims and non-Muslims can live together. So that'll be the fear of the authorities. I guess the view of certainly some of the local resident Muslims that I've met as well, you know, this was all bound to happen given all that the focus that there is on terrorism carried out by Islamic extremists. But I guess you might say to that, well, what are you going to do about that?
Rob, meanwhile, as we're learning more about this attack, we're also learning more about the terrible fire last week at Grenfell Tower, where the death toll has now risen to at least 79.
Yes, I mean, as far as I know, that is by far and away the worst fire in living memory. But it's obviously more than just that in terms of casualties. It sparked off this huge row, as you'll know, in Britain about what was done for the housing of the poor, the gap between rich and poor, and about the Prime Minister's abilities as a politician. Should she have got there early? Should she have empathised more? So, as well as being the most appalling lack of loss of life, and I know I spent much of last week standing at the bottom of that tower talking to people, it's had these far broader political ramifications and spin-offs.
And this is a Prime Minister, by the way, who still hasn't formed a new government after her losses in the elections.
Absolutely right. I mean, if you were to look at this from the outside, you might say someone's got it in for the UK at the moment. I mean, I don't mean to trivialise it in any way, but yeah, you have this spate of attacks, you have the fire, you have a government that's really struggling, a Prime Minister struggling for authority, and all at the time when Britain is trying to embark on surely the most complex negotiation in the last 40 years, which is its new relationship with the European Union once it leaves. I mean, you just couldn't make this stuff up.
Well, let's talk about that, because the Brexit negotiations, amazingly, start today with everything else going on. What's the process here? What does Britain want to get out of these talks?
Well, I suppose if you were to put what does Britain want simply, it wants all the things that it liked about the European Union membership, so plenty of free trade, exchange of services, and none of the things that it didn't like, such as being part of the political union, a political project, such as having free movement of people, and such as paying $10 billion a year or so into the EU's coffers. Now, it seems to me that in the end, the big question of this debate is, you know, Britain basically wants its cake, to have its cake and eat it. The question is, you know, is there some way that the European Union can meet Britain some of the way? Because, of course, the European Union's bottom line is, look, we don't wish you any harm in Britain. We wish you were still staying. But you can't have a better deal outside the European Union than inside. Otherwise, what on earth would be the point of being a member?
How long are these talks going to go on?
Well, they're supposed to go on until, potentially, until March of 2019, because that's when the deadline looms. In 2 years from Theresa May having triggered Article 50 back in March of this year, that's it, it's over. We're either bounce out without a deal, we have a deal, or I suppose theoretically we could decide to stay in, or there could be some kind of a transition arrangement. But it is a truly extraordinary moment in British history.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, joining us from London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Does that attack on Muslims outside a mosque by a non-Muslim play into the ISIS playbook? There is such a thing. Actually, it's a handbook written 2 years ago. Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
And you know the writing I'm referring to. It was actually from authors sympathetic to ISIS. And in part, they wrote, after ISIS attacks, then Muslims and mosques will be attacked, and then Muslims will do counter-protests. This is how the future jihad in Europe will begin. In other words, ISIS is hoping that there is a reaction to their attacks so that they can draw more Muslims into the fight.
I think one of the issues that ISIS certainly hopes, and we have seen it in Europe probably better than in any other location, is the hope of sparking a clash of civilizations. And it's not just a clash between Islam and other religions. It's in some cases a clash within Islam between Sunnis and Shia. But I think what we've seen in France is an encouragement of individuals in the banlieues, in the locations outside of cities, for Muslims that have been disenfranchised to stand up and fight, support the Islamic State, and to fight against the state. And there's a general action-reaction that they are hoping, a legitimate clash of civilizations that they hope to incur and to bring larger numbers of individuals to their cause.
Well, the Washington Post reminds us today that after the January 2015 attacks on the Charlie Hebdo magazine in Paris, ISIS leaders explained that the attacks would compel the crusaders to actively destroy the gray zone themselves. And by that, they meant constitutional or legal protections. And some in Britain are saying that Theresa May is already falling into that trap. You know, earlier this month, during the election, she said if human rights laws get in the way of protecting Britain, she would change those laws. But it's tough because after the most recent attacks, Brits are calling on her to do something about the, you know, hundreds of ISIS sympathizers that are known to be in the country that an overwhelmed security force is trying to monitor. So there's sort of between a rock and a hard place there.
Yeah, I think there's no question that intelligence services across Europe and even in North America are overwhelmed with the number of targets. But I don't think most people are signing up because of state actions like the actions of security services. I think what we've seen is that people who've generally radicalized and signed up have been either encouraged by what they see as the possibility of a state being created in areas like Iraq and Syria, which is in trouble right now, or actions taken in their home countries that oppress Muslims. Not that oppress citizens more broadly or are viewed as oppressing citizens, like penetration of populations, but that oppress Muslims specifically. They ban headscarves. I think that's what has wooed some individuals in France and the UK and other locations to ISIS.
Well, and that seems to be a caution not to loosen, you know, these legal protections. But this is the main question we wanted to ask you. How strong is ISIS? We heard that Raqqa in Syria was falling. The group is fighting back in Mosul in Iraq. Well, how strong is ISIS?
I think in order to answer the question, you've got to look at a number of indicators. So how strong is ISIS? Well, they're not doing particularly well on some fronts. They have lost considerable territory, not just in Iraq and Syria, but also in Libya, in Afghanistan, in Nigeria, and in Egypt, and in a few other places where they control territory. The number of fighters that they have fighting for them and the number of jihadist groups that they may work with have come down slightly over the past 2 years. Public opinion polls, including polls done by Pew Charitable Trust, indicate lowering support for ISIS, and that's particularly in the Arab world. So along those lines, they're not doing well. And remember, ISIS is an organization that is committed to establishing a pan-Islamic caliphate. So territory and populations that they control are important. They're also important for taxation,
which is where they get their revenue. But we just read that ISIS just captured Tora Bora in Afghanistan and that there are U.S. troops now on the ground aiding in the fight against ISIS in the Philippines.
There's no question that they have made limited progress in a few areas. ISIS has reached out to the Abu Sayyaf group in Mindanao, for example, and attempted to surge. But in terms of total control of territory, they've got a net loss. On the other side, ISIS continues to have cell structures in a number of places, and they've actually increased their number of attacks in a range of areas. So when you look at a number of indicators, they have not done well along some of those lines, but they still remain a dangerous and, frankly, a global movement.
Seth Jones, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Imagine a candidate for office with more experience in entertainment than politics. No, I'm not talking about President Trump. I'm talking about Jesse Ventura, who shocked the political world back in the late 90s when he went from being a pro wrestler to independent governor of Minnesota. Well, now he's back, about to start hosting a show on RT America, a branch of Russian state television. He's also got a book out called Jesse Ventura's Marijuana Manifesto, and he joins us from New York. Jesse Ventura, welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, and let's start with the news. You've been in the news because you've got a new television show. Why did you want to do a show on Russian state television?
Well, because it's the same as PBS, really. It's just financed by the Russian government. My internet show had played on there for a while, and they don't censor me. They allow me to speak freely, and they've virtually told me they will never, ever do anything. I can talk about any subject matter that I want. And it seems bizarre to me because I'm 65 and I grew up and lived through the entire Cold War, that it's the Russians who are giving me free speech when I'm kind of blackballed here in the United States. You know, I don't get the interviews that I should because I ask and raise questions that a lot of people makes them uncomfortable. So I've kind of skipping over U.S. national media and going to international media, which I find very appealing.
Well, what do you mean that the U.S. media doesn't want to talk to you?
Well, I've been censored here many, many times. I'll give you the great story. When I came out of office, I was the hottest commodity out there in 2003. A bidding war happened between CNN, Fox, and MSNBC, and I subsequently signed with MSNBC. We were creating the show. They had just signed Phil Donahue, and Phil was their highest-rated show. And all of a sudden, we got a phone call that questioning, did I agree with the invasion of Iraq, which I've always opposed. I opposed it before it happened. I opposed it when it happened. And I oppose it today. Well, my show wasn't allowed on. They pulled Phil Donahue, and everybody who would have spoken out against the invasion of Iraq was not allowed on television. If you think back, there was nobody saying anything against it. Nobody.
So you say that RT is not going to censor you. They're not going to tell you what to say. But do you have any concerns?
They haven't yet.
Well, they haven't yet. Okay.
Well, they've played my internet show for the last year, and that was one of the reasons they picked me up. And now let me state why I want to do it. My mother and father are both World War II veterans. Not many people can say that their mom was. Well, my dad had 6 bronze battle stars. He fought in North Africa, Normandy, Remagen Bridge, Battle of the Bulge, Anzio, and Berlin. And he didn't talk much about the war to me as a kid. But what he did talk about was when he got to Berlin and the fantastic friendship he made with the Russians. Well, before the war was even over, Russia became our enemy. Why? Because they were communist and were run by Wall Street. And Wall Street's biggest fear is socialism. They'd rather get in bed with Nazis or fascists any day than a socialist. So we became immediate enemies of Russia. Well, I'm sick of it. My entire 65 years on the planet, we've had this Cold War with Russia going on. My belief is, how about being friends for a while? We can always go back to being enemies. Maybe we can accomplish something by being friends. So if what I do helps bridge that gap, I'm happy to do it in the latter years of my life now when I have to pick out what I'm going to work on, and I can't do everything.
Well, but Jesse Ventura, what about what the intelligence agencies have just said about what Russia just did in our election and trying to meddle in our election?
Does really? That... Well, let's look at some hypocrisy for a moment. Nobody says this. This is what you're going to hear on Jesse Ventura's show. How many elections worldwide have we interfered in? A lot of them. Tons of them. Dozens of them. And then I watched the big one on TV. CBS had it the other day. The NSA said this and that. And then they actually did a disclaimer at the end. They said, but it was assured it had no bearing on the results of our election. Well, then who cares? This is like spy versus spy in Mad Magazine.
You've met Vladimir Putin, by the way, right?
Yeah, they flew me to Russia because I wanted to. I didn't do this haphazardly. They flew me to Moscow, and I went to the 10-year anniversary of RT. Vladimir Putin was the keynote speaker that night, and I'll give you my impression of Vladimir Putin. I think he is a patriotic Russian. Now, shouldn't the president of Russia be a patriotic Russian?
Well, yeah, but he could be a patriotic Russian and try a little less hard to harm the United States, as some people believe that he has been doing for a long time.
As worked as our media and our propaganda tells you he's doing.
You think
Let's
that's propaganda?
Let's remember that. I think a lot of it is. Russia has so many problems of their own. They're changing over from being communist to capitalist. We have no idea what that would be like. They are going through a period of change in Russia. But you know, when I was there, the people were happy. The people were smiling. They were so friendly. And I viewed it as this. We're two ships in the night. We're heading to where Russia used to be, and Russia's heading to where we used to be. Have we met yet? I don't think so. But we're heading in the wrong directions.
What do you think of the Trump presidency so far?
I don't like it because I'm a huge climate advocate, and I think that pulling out of Paris is the worst decision this country could have possibly made. We're so stupid here. We want to go backwards instead of forward. Why would we want to back up to coal again, to fossil fuel again? Let's strive to the future, Donald Trump. Take us in like Star Trek to places we haven't been.
Do you see any comparisons between yourself and Donald Trump?
No, because he joined the Republicans. He's a Republican. Jesse Ventura does not belong to either of these gangs, the Democrats or the Republicans, as I call them. Hmm. He joined the Republican Party. Now, he beat the two dynasties, the Bushes first and then the Clintons, which is I cheered for that. He won the election. But he's still a hardcore Republican by the people he's chosen. And these people, they think, I guess, that somehow the Lord is going to save us because he promised after Noah's Ark that he'd never flood the earth again. So I guess they figure climate change will be handled by God.
Let me ask you about marijuana, which
sure.
is an issue that's very important to you, and you've written
yep.
a book about it. And you write in your book, I believe there's a way to win the war against the drug cartels. America and Mexico would have to legalize all drugs that have the potential for substance abuse, just like we do with tobacco and alcohol. Legalizing marijuana alone isn't enough.
Absolutely. If you want to end the deaths and end the cartels and these drug wars and these massive killings and things, the only way to do it is through legalization. Fighting them with armies and all that and causing violence, violence leads to violence. And that isn't the way to solve it. The solve it is to use intellect and smarts. And even my mother said to me, the World War II vet, who is a nurse, she said to me before she passed on, she said, you know, the war on drugs is identical to the prohibition of alcohol. She said, all you're doing is making criminals rich and powerful. You're making criminals rich and powerful by keeping these things illegal. I'm not saying you sell them at the 7-Eleven. I'm saying you'd sell them in hospitals and clinics. It's a disease. Addiction is a disease. to where the addict can go seek help instead of being put in prison to support privatized prisons so that corporations can make money.
Well, if you were in charge right now, what would you do about, let's say, the opioid crisis? What would the first thing you would do?
The first thing I would do about it is I would lift the federal ban on marijuana, because every state that has legalized marijuana has seen a drop in opiate use. Every one. It's gone right against the lies they've told us. They've told us marijuana is a gateway drug that will lead you to the opiates, when it's the opposite. Well, the opiate war needs to be fought against pharma, because it's pharma who created it by putting out OxyContin and all these pills that got people addicted. And then what did they do? They went, all these pills are part of heroin. They're all in the same family, the opiate family. So then you get heroin epidemics out there.
Well, if you look at what's happening in this country right now, you do have a number of states that are legalizing marijuana, but at the same time, in Washington, it looks like you're going to have a tougher position from the Trump administration on legalization.
Well, it shouldn't be, because Donald Trump's people just said they pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord and they said it's a state's issue. Well, they should handle marijuana the same way. It should be a state's issue. Look what's happened in Colorado. If Trump wants to create jobs, 18,000 new jobs in Colorado with a $2.4 billion to their Colorado's economy.
Do you want to get back into politics, Jesse Ventura?
No.
That's it?
I want to be doing what I'm doing.
That's Jesse Ventura, the former independent governor of Minnesota, who is going to be hosting a new show on RT. That's Russia Today. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
You in the American Southwest are used to hot weather. Phoenix has seen 118 11 times, but it's seeing 120, and that's only happened four times in recorded history, twice in the 1990s. Weather Channel meteorologist Jen Carfagno is here. And Jen, how widespread is this?
This is a really big heat wave. As of Monday morning, we have 34 million people under some type of heat advisory or watch or warning. It encompasses California and Arizona, Nevada, also, you know, parts of New Mexico, and even extends into West Texas.
Yeah. So this is big. And how high are the temperatures expected to be?
The temperatures are 120 plus. For a couple of places, which are significant. Death Valley hit 120 for the first time of the season. That happened on Saturday, and then 124 on Sunday. This happens. They usually have about 3 days a year where they hit 125 plus, but it's still pretty hot and can be excessive and dangerous when you're outside. Phoenix is going up to 120. Las Vegas is going up into the 110s for maybe 5 or 6 days in a row.
Well, even Flagstaff, which is at 7,000 feet, you know, a lot of people there don't even have air conditioners. We understand they're in the 90s.
Yes, it's widespread. It's widespread heat down to the valley floors, up in the mountains. You can't even get much of a break from the heat there. And in the overnights, you don't get a break. And that's part of what makes a heat wave so dangerous. Temperatures in Phoenix may not drop below 90 degrees. And that only happens one or two times a year. Your body just never gets a break unless you're in the air conditioning.
We'll talk about, you know, why people are being told to hydrate so much. The only way a body can recover, I think it's above 110 degrees, is to really sweat profusely to try to combat the heat. And you can only do that if you're taking in a lot of liquids.
And a challenge with this dry heat that we have in the Southwest, it may not feel as humid and muggy as it does in the Southeast when it gets heat, for example. But because it is so dry, you know, any water that your body excretes, whether it's a sweat or otherwise, just, you know, quickly evaporates out into the air. So you need even to drink more water than you might think.
Well, we also know it's harder for airplanes to take off
when it's so hot because heat changes the air density. So airports are looking at this, power grids looking at it. We mentioned, you know, health emergency rooms. Why is it happening?
There is a very strong mega ridge, as we like to call it, in the jet stream. Basically, a ridge in the jet stream means that we have a lot of sinking air aloft. And, you know, it's a big dome of heat, so to speak. Sinking air is a drying process. It's also a warming process. And the numbers are high in terms of the strength of this ridge. And it lasts. So it began this weekend. The peak is going to be on Tuesday and Wednesday. And then it does extend all the way into the end of the week and early next weekend.
Wow. So the usual cautions, I mean, don't leave kids or pets in the car, check on the elderly.
You need to take the usual cautions when it comes to this kind of heat. Beat the heat, check the back seat is a great tagline that the National Weather Service uses to make sure you don't forget kids or pets in the back seat of your car. You also need to take this very seriously. This is beyond a dry heat of the desert Southwest in the summertime. It can be dangerous. It's actually pretty rare to get this hot for this length of time, and it can be deadly if you don't take it seriously. So officials have advised not doing anything extraneous outside between the hours of about noon and 6 p.m.
Okay. Weather Channel meteorologist Jen Carfagno. Jen, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Let's hear that again. Beat the heat, check the back seat. Penn State is considering reforms after videotape showed that Beta Theta Pi pledge Timothy Piazza died after being forced to drink alcohol, falling downstairs, going into spasms for 12 hours before someone called 911. But in an editorial in Time magazine, Occidental College sociology professor Lisa Wade says, don't reform, get rid of frats. For good. She joins us. And Professor Lisa, I'm sure you're hearing from young men who say, but fraternities changed my life for the good.
I'm very sensitive to that. Unfortunately, what we know from hundreds of research studies over decades is that these are, in fact, the most dangerous places on college campuses. If someone is going to be fatally injured on a college campus, if they're going to be disabled on a college campus, if they're going to end up with alcohol poisoning or be sexually assaulted, the chances that it happens at or originates at a fraternity house, that is the most likely case.
Tell us a little bit about the history. It starts in 1863 with the third president of Amherst asking his fellow college presidents what they think of this brand new thing called a fraternity.
Oh, almost unanimously, they thought that fraternities were just about the worst thing that ever had happened to college campuses. They thought that nothing good could come of young men meeting in secret and setting their own agenda. They desperately wanted to get rid of them. They called them un-American. They felt like that they sowed dissension and made non-fraternity members feel bad about themselves and excluded from campus life. And fraternities, from their very inception, have been about rebelling from administration, giving them the middle finger, partying to the point of perilousness. They were born out of 100 years of rioting on college campuses, rioting that was initiated by wealthy students who came to college at a time when college was actually pretty boring and they had to subordinate themselves to administration and faculty. They had much less tolerance for boredom and subordination than did the middle-class men who had been going before them. And so they started violent uprisings. And I'm not talking about, you know, protests with clever signs. I mean, they brought arson and firearms. College presidents had to bring in militias. At one point, the college presidents all agreed amongst themselves to expel any student caught rioting. They also agreed not to accept into their own institutions someone that had been expelled from another one. And every single college president at the time agreed to do this except for one guy who was the president of Union College in Schenectady, New York. And he decided to take in all of those violent, wayward sons. And it was at that college in 1825 where the first social fraternity was formed, Kappa Alpha.
Huh. You're reminding us of the class system in America, that a lot of these wealthier, more elite young men in these colleges that were rioting, in part it was because I'm guessing that the teachers, the professors came from a kind of lesser class than they did. So were these early fraternities a way of these wealthy young men cutting themselves off from this campus that they didn't really respect?
Yeah, so in the colonial era, colleges were mostly places where young middle-class men went to become ministers, and their teachers, the faculty members, were also mostly ministers. Wealthy families start sending their sons to college because they are looking around for some sort of thing that, with which they can justify the hoarding of wealth and power that they are doing in America. And they decide that the diploma is what they're going to sort of hang this hoarding on. And so they send their young sons, these wealthy sons, to college campuses, and they're looking around, suddenly surrounded by these middle-class people, students that they see as less than them. And that is exactly part of the reason that they start these fraternities, is a way to exclude those middle-class men from their social environments and create places where they can, again, hoard and consolidate their own power and resources.
And in the 1860s, you write, a Yale grad argued that fraternity men were said to manage the entire system of college politics. They wanted to run the show, and a 1900 account from Northwestern University reported that fraternity men conspired to ensure that only they received the scholarships, the leadership positions, and the awards.
That's right. And on some campuses, you couldn't even be in the yearbook if you weren't in a fraternity, because fraternity men controlled the yearbook. They grabbed outsized power on college campuses right from the beginning, and they still have outsized power on college campuses. And that's specifically why people don't imagine that it's possible to get rid of fraternities. When I speak about this on college campuses, that's the reaction I get, is administrators and faculty and students saying that's impossible. And it boggles my mind, because in the 200 years we've had fraternities, we've ended slavery, we've given women the vote, we've gone to the moon. The idea that we don't have the power to stop them, I think, is really quite scary, because it does point to just how much power they still wield.
But they have houses on campus. It's almost like, you know, they have boots on the ground, they have a foothold. It's something that people can actually see. And there are, as you heard, people who absolutely believe in their purpose. NPR recently aired a series, Men in America, in which they interviewed former frat members who said frats gave them mentors, they did charity work. One said frats helped him become a man, and that the horror stories, like at Penn State, are rare.
The horrible stories aren't rare enough to justify keeping these organizations around. I can speak to some of the objections that people have against getting rid of fraternities. One is the charity work argument, that they give a lot of money to charity. I actually looked up the North American Intrafraternity Conference data on this. On average, their members donate $50 a year to charity and spend 9 hours doing charity work. That's on average each year. So I'm not really overwhelmed by the amount of charity work they're doing. I'm not saying that they don't do it, just that I don't think it's their primary purpose. A lot of fraternity men argue that there is a freedom of association in the United States and that we cannot take away their right to associate. As of now, the courts really aren't holding up this argument. The strongest cases for freedom of association are intimate association, which are families, and expressive association, which is an association that's about a particular goal or belief. So you might imagine a social movement organization would be an expressive organization, or a religion. But the courts aren't holding up that fraternities and sororities count as expressive organizations. They also do mention that it's meaningful to them, and it turns them from boys to men, you might say. And I actually find that a little worrisome. I don't think that it's a good idea to be encouraging young males to identify specifically as men over and against women in this country anymore. So I kind of think that the way in which we sex segregate fraternities and sororities, for the most part, is doing more harm than good. And all these other nice benefits that come from it, friendship, leadership training, study groups, none of these things need a fraternity to happen.
What about the notion, instead of banning them outright, reform, make them better?
If you look at where fraternities came from, that 100 years of rioting, that desire to give a middle finger to administrators and faculty, the interest in partying, and not just partying for a good time, but partying to the point of perilousness, the desire to create a certain degree of danger and risk. That is how fraternities came to be. That is what fraternities have been about. And so to ask them to be reasonable, to take precautions and be careful, is really to ask them to betray everything that they've stood for the last 200 years.
Well,
and I really just think that reform is... It's a fool's errand. And the Timothy Piazza case is exactly why. That fraternity, Beta Theta Pi at Penn, was considered a model fraternity. It was a reformed fraternity. It was a dry fraternity where no alcohol was ever supposed to be served. And yet, we still saw this absolutely grotesque tragedy, an unnecessary tragedy, happen, specifically because the goal was to create a party environment that was dangerous.
Beta Theta Pi also had live-in adult supervision and video surveillance, which is why we're seeing these horrendous videos of what happened to Timothy Piazza.
That fraternity was, quote-unquote, doing everything right, and yet we still saw this tragedy.
That's Lisa Wade. She teaches sociology at Occidental College in Los Angeles. We'll link you to her article in Time titled Why Colleges Should Get Rid of Fraternities for Good. By the way, Lisa is also author of American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus. Professor Wade, Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you for highlighting this issue.
Cutbacks may be ahead at Whole Foods. Amazon announced that it's buying the grocery chain last week, and Bloomberg News reports that Amazon is expected to cut jobs and change inventory. The goal is to bring down prices and shed that whole paycheck image. Amazon has not confirmed any changes, but as we wait to see what happens, The Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson writes that the purchase is going to change not just the future of the food industry, but the future of how we shop for everything. Derek joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jamie.
And make your case. What does this mean for the future of the food industry and how we shop overall?
If Amazon is shaping the future of food, then the future is going to be cheap, it's going to be convenient, and it's going to be shipped in boxes. In the short term, it's reasonable to imagine Amazon operating a Whole Foods simply like a cheaper Whole Foods, no longer Whole Paycheck, as you said. But in the long run, I think Amazon has two important uses for Whole Foods groceries. First, it wants to put Amazon into Whole Foods stores. And second, it wants Whole Foods in Amazon boxes. That is, it wants to sort of Amazonify the whole Whole Foods experience in the brick and mortar locations, with price experiments, bundling experiments, use Whole Foods to understand how people shop inside of a real store, which is a new interest of Amazon's. But second, Whole Foods as a delivery service. You're sitting at home, you're watching a movie, you've got a dinner party this week, and you turn to your Alexa and you say, Alexa, I need heirloom tomatoes and golden beets from Whole Foods. And Friday afternoon arrives, and there it comes in a refrigerated box just in time for the weekend salad. So books in boxes, you know, get ready for beets in boxes.
But isn't there also a problem with that, and that Amazon has seen in the past, which is that people want to go and pick out their meat, their fish, their fruits and vegetables. They don't trust that somebody else is going to do it well for them and then just ship it off to them.
This is a really interesting point. On the one hand, I think there are some people who, of course, just want to stay with their Whole Foods habits, right? They want to go, they want to browse, they want to touch the merchandise. But there's a lot of people who are either harried, they don't have time to drive to Whole Foods, or they're purely lazy. They love just staying at home and watching, you know, episodes 1 through 7 on Netflix. And for those people, they're going to love a product that delivers Whole Foods rather than forcing them to go out and park and, you know, wait in line 6 for 5 minutes. I think it's important to realize that, you know, you have a product like Blue Apron right now that's growing really, really quickly, about to have its IPO. Blue Apron delivers essentially groceries to people so that they can cook organic meals, really fancy meals with the groceries that are shipped. It's growing like gangbusters in terms of revenue, and it speaks precisely to this interest that people are really harried for time. They have scarce time with kids and work and all these extracurricular stuff. Sometimes they just want their beets in boxes.
Do you think that Amazon is going to do something between Amazon Prime and Whole Foods? Because they have done that with other partnerships where these Amazon Prime members, I mean, right now, Whole Foods is probably the only store that you can go to that has absolutely no rewards program, right? So are they right. going to start to do something?
Yes, I do think it's reasonable to think that Whole Foods could become more like Costco, which is to say you have a membership program right now with Amazon Prime for faster deliveries. You hook that up with Whole Foods, maybe charge a little bit more for it. This market of richer Amazon customers, people making over $100,000 who are already maybe spending hundreds of dollars a month at Whole Foods, they're going to be really, really interested in getting a deal there, right? So now you not only add more people to the Prime program, but also maybe you can upcharge people who are already paying for Chime. There's all sorts of ways that you can essentially look to this demographic that already enjoys the Amazon Prime market and shops at Whole Foods and say essentially, let us own your paycheck. Let us own your food and extracurricular budget. That, I think, is an enormous part of Amazon's sort of attempt to lock in that customer.
Derek, you also write that Amazon is trying to become Walmart faster than Walmart can become Amazon. What do you mean by that?
Right. Yeah. Amazon's trying to become Walmart faster than Walmart can become Amazon. So Amazon is a little more upscale, mostly online, growing really, really quickly. Walmart caters more to a lower income consumer, and its footprint is in brick and mortar. Walmart is trying to buy a lot of digital retail companies like Bonobos, which it just bought, to become more like Amazon, while Amazon just bought a brick and mortar retailer and is offering now discounts to low income shoppers, trying to become more like Walmart. So I do think that this is going to be one of the more fascinating tete-a-tetes, one of the more fascinating showdowns in the U.S. economy in the next decade. Amazon versus Walmart, the two sort of megaliths of retail going at it for a long, long time.
Who has the edge right now?
I mean, it's interesting. So right now, last time I checked, I think when it comes to pure revenue, I think Walmart is three times bigger than Amazon. Mm. But Amazon is growing like crazy, and Walmart isn't growing much at all. So you look at this situation in the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, Amazon could catch up to and then surpass Walmart. That's why its stock price is so much higher. I would never, ever bet against Jeff Bezos. He has shown in the last decade that not only can he hypnotize financiers on Wall Street to not bet against him, even as he turns no profit or minuscule profits year after year, but also he's showing that he is interested in taking a cut on every single segment of the U.S. economy.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And later today on All Things Considered, we'll go inside one of Amazon's massive distribution centers where robots and artificial intelligence are working to get stuff shipped to customers quickly. But Amazon is finding that robots have limits. That story later on All Things Considered. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.